Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. We're on Huntley Community Radio 101.5 on your FM dial. Don't forget it. I don't want you to leave me. Well, to begin with today, we are going to take a relatively brief field trip. We've been taking field trips with each program recently, and today's is going to be entitled Florida Beach. It starts at Tarpon Springs, Florida, and it ends at Sanibel Island, Florida, a distance of 170 miles. Within 1,350 miles of unbroken coastline, Florida is America's undisputed sand and surf playground. And its undisputed seaside capital is Miami, Daytona, Key West. In fact, last year, TripAdvisor reported that the top beach in Florida, in fact, in all of America, is Siesta Key. It's just south of Sarasota. If you've never heard of it, perhaps that's because Floridians try to keep this most coveted secret to themselves. Siesta Key is one of the many underappreciated and not too crowded beaches that you will find on this drive along Florida's aptly named Sun Coast. Start on Route 19, northwest of Tampa, and head south through slice after slice of sandy Gulf paradise, including Tarpon Springs, which is the sponge capital of the world, the Scottish-like fishing village of Dunedin, and Clearwater's Caladasy Island, which Dr. Beach, that is, AKA Stephen Leatherman, PhD, director of the Laboratory for Coastal Research at Florida International University, has put at the top of his own best beaches in America list. The turquoise-tinged beauty is everywhere. Fort DeSoto Park delivers sunsets to rival Key West's any day, and it's home to a menagerie of pelicans and herons, egrets, sea turtles, and Florida's iconic dolphins. Travel a few hours south on I-75 and over the Sanibel Causeway to Sanibel and Captiva Islands, two old Florida retreats with no buildings taller than a palm tree. Together, the two islands claim the title of Seashell Capital of the World, a distinction they owe to a quirk of geography. They are among the few barrier islands that run perpendicular to the mainland. That allows them to snag the currents, conch, whelk, and other shells in their crescent-shaped clutches. Stop over, and you might find yourself captive to the island's charms also. Good advice for a vacation drive. And now, our second item today, news from Australia. Australia is set to open international borders for both Australian nationals and others, and open these borders by Christmas at the latest. The country implemented one of the world's strictest controls on overseas incoming and outgoing travel since the pandemic began in 2020. Even movement between states for Australians is restricted. Australians would be expected to travel with proof of vaccination as a CR code linked to their passport. So, you see, other places have much more restriction than we have had. And then third on our item list today is an article about tongue twisters, which delight word lovers across the globe. What is the most difficult tongue twister in the English language? What about the most difficult in any language? On social media and YouTube, in language classes, and in scholarly books, word lovers around the world are having fun trying to answer these questions, mangling many mouths full of morphemes as they go. Let's first check in with the experts. According to the Guinness Book of World Records, the most challenging English twister is the following: the sixth sick sheik's sixth sheep's sick. It plays around with the KSTH consonant cluster, and a difficult enough sound for many native English speakers, let alone speakers of English as a second language. Guinness stopped monitoring the tongue twister category in 1974. But we turn to the academics for updated information. In 2013, speech communication scientists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology developed a particularly tricky twister to help them study the ways speech can go wrong. For example, pad, kid, poured, curd, pulled, cod. While this is nowhere near as elegant as the previous one, it's extremely hard to say. None of the scientists' test subjects could get through it 10 times. And I find it hard to say even once. I'll say it once again, and then in the privacy of your room, you can practice 10 times. Pad kid, poured curd, pulled cod. Well, tongue twisters in other languages present a range of challenges for English speakers. The most difficult twister in the world, according to the 1974 Guinness Records, comes from the Xhosa language. I won't attempt to say these words in Xhosa, but translated they mean the skunk rolled down and ruptured its larynx. This is even harder than the English transcription makes it seem, since it includes click consonants, which are made by sucking air in against various parts of the mouth and are extremely difficult for non-native speakers to reproduce. While English has some hefty consonant clusters of its own, they're nothing compared with those found in Slavic languages and in the Georgian language. Czech, for example, has a tongue twister with no vowels, but plenty of rolled R's. Again, the translation, I beg your patience on this. Stick your finger through your throat is what it comes out to mean. A single Georgian word could be a tongue twister. And it, translated, means you peel us, and has 8 consonant sounds before it comes to its lone vowel. Then there are tonal languages, which use pitch to distinguish words. In the 1930s, Chinese linguist Yuan Ren Chao wrote quite a long poem called Xi Xi, Xi Xi Xi, but with the meaning in English, it would be lion eating poet in the stone den, using, as you can see from the English translation, only she, and relying on Mandarin's 4 different tones. To me, this one takes the peck of pickled peppers. If you're interested, you can find examples of all of these on YouTube. Have a listen and let us know what you think. Which ones would you pick? You may have read the Chicago Tribune this past Sunday, and on the front page is a very interesting article. Mystery blooms in Lake Superior. Scientists are studying the increase in algae in one of the world's fastest warming lakes. At the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore in Wisconsin, kayakers stood for a moment on the beach, marveling at the clear sweep of blue. On a warm fall day, along the south shore of one of the world's largest freshwater lakes, the sun lolled toward the horizon, miles out from the peppered, coppered grains of sand anchoring the kayaks. Lake Superior's Caribbean blue water and cold temperatures and its vastness are enough to all, even the most staid person. It's all perfect beach along the shore and perfect water offshore when it's not green. A bloom of blue-green algae or cyanobacteria has appeared in Lake Superior about a decade ago, for the first time, sending scientists in search of answers to why a worrisome problem was surfacing in a lake that holds a tenth of the Earth's surface fresh water. The blooms, which have cropped up in all of the Great Lakes, can deplete oxygen, cut off light, harm organisms that are trapped underneath. They sometimes create toxins that threaten the health of fish, and dogs, and humans, make their way into water intakes. Just how and why toxins accompany some blooms is still a bit of a mystery. With their ephemeral nature, the handful of blooms that have occurred in Lake Superior have been mostly small and short-lived. So samples and good data are limited at the moment. Since the first reported Lake Superior bloom in 2012, no serious levels of toxins had been confirmed. But that all changed last month with a bloom near Superior, Wisconsin, that left a beach's water streaky green. A toxin more potent than cyanide was detected just beyond the level which is set for safe swimming by the EPA. confirmation gave scientists pause. Another change. Lake Superior is among the world's fastest warming freshwater bodies and has increasingly borne the force of what used to be considered once in a lifetime storm. Weather extremes fueled by human-caused climate change may imperil the lake, whose reputation rests on its unspoiled water. Algae blooms are generally driven by temperature, sunlight, water conditions, and nutrients, primarily phosphorus, which can come from farm fertilizer and manure that eventually wash into the lakes. But among the Great Lakes, Lake Superior is an anomaly. Unlike Lake Erie and Green Bay and Lake Michigan, warmer, shallower, and surrounded by sources of agricultural runoff, Lake Superior is cold and deep and nutrient poor. Blooms have appeared in northern Canadian waters, but most span a popular recreational stretch from Duluth to the Apostle Islands, where land cover is largely forest and woody wetlands. Agriculture and urban detritus are minimal. Climate change appears to be a primary actor. The data have convinced scientists that the changing climate system has pushed Lake Superior into a new state, one where we get these blue-green blooms. One of the things that's driving their work is, if in fact we're in the beginning of something that's getting worse, we really owe it to the world to try to understand the circumstances best we can and do it now. A group of Midwestern scientists can't reverse the decades of burned fossil fuels or a lack of political will. But what they can do is to head out into the water and study it. So this summer, a boost in funding, which came from the Cooperative Science and Monitoring Initiative, an ongoing binational survey of the Great Lakes, helped to pay for the scientific studies, which carried on throughout the summer. Scientists from local universities and state and federal agencies, assisted by real-time buoys and even an underwater glider, named for the genus of the common loon, have been out into the lake. And also, they've been in the lab. They've been collecting, filtering, and testing, hoping that the water tells a story. What scientists can learn from Lake Superior may benefit other lakes already struggling with algae blooms. As climate change threatens to make them worse, blooms can contain different cyanobacteria species, which may fuel or hinder growth. And there are different genetic lines or strains. For example, within one species, you can have strains that have the genes for toxin production, and you can have species that do not have these genes for toxin production. The really important thing that scientists are trying to figure out is, what are the conditions that lead to toxin production. That is the conundrum so all important at the moment. Artificial intelligence is turning out to be not so smart. This, according to Bloomberg.com. What do Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk have in common? Besides being among the world's richest men, they are both grappling with big problems that stem, at least in part, from putting faith in artificial intelligence systems that have under-delivered. As the head of Facebook, Zuckerberg has often touted the company's machine learning algorithms before even mentioning its army of human moderators. But humans have proven adept at outwitting the system using constructions like Va-in to avoid detection. Musk, the CEO of Tesla, likewise keeps making premature AI promises. After saying that Tesla would have 1 million driverless robo-taxis on the streets by 2020, Musk has at least conceded that self-driving technology is a hard problem. And today, Tesla customers pay an extra $10,000 for software that enables cars to park, change lanes, and drive onto the highway by themselves, with the occasional serious mistake. AI is falling short in other areas too. A study in the British Medical Journal earlier this year found that 94% of AI systems that scanned for signs of breast cancer were less accurate than the analysis of a single radiologist. We can forgive the machines if they mess up our movie recommendations, but in high-stakes situations, it's becoming clearer that AI is not quite ready, perhaps, for prime time. And then, I hope you are out driving around looking for the best areas of color during the fall season, and I have a hint or a clue for you here. The best fall foliage map, with the help of SmokyMountain.com, fall 2021 could be your most colorful autumn ever. The website was created by the founders of a Tennessee-based travel booking company and is home to an unusually useful U.S. foliage map that lets you pinpoint when every county in the country will peak. Like a weather forecast, the map, SmokyMountains.com/fall foliage map, will never be perfectly accurate, but its predictions derive from the compilation of a large body of data, including forecasts from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. This year, the creators updated the data at mid-season for the first time, making the predictions even better for regions that tend to peak later. And those regions are in places such as North Carolina and Washington State. Welcome back. You'll just be here for a short time because we've come to the end of today's program. But I wanted to tell you what we're going to be talking about in the next program. You'll want to tune in. I think you'll enjoy the comments about fossilized footprints of the first Americans, giraffes who like a fair fight, coronavirus, and air travel, and then, of all things, a killer whale with four legs. Sounds like an exciting time talking about science on our next get together. So it's time for us to put away the notes, close the drawers, and sign off. We want you to please come back to 101.5 on your dial, your FM dial, Huntley Community Radio is here to serve you. We want to entertain you, sometimes amuse you a bit, but we certainly want you to come back. And you take care of yourself. As you do that, you will actually be helping all of us. And so I'm going to call on my friend Willie Nelson once again, as we always do, to go on down the road again and look for some things, for a little of this, a little of that. Take it, Willie.